Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Michael Lofton Show here on Reason and Theology with returning guest Tyler McNabb, who is going to be going over Buddhism from a Catholic perspective. Tyler, welcome back to the show. How are you?
Thanks very much. It's an honor to be here and looking forward to a fun conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, tell me a little bit about your background in relation to Buddhism. What got you interested in studying it?
Yeah, so I discuss Buddhism a bit, especially the Mahayana tradition. For those who know who Nagarjuna is, his tradition. During my PhD thesis, when I was writing a comparative religious epistemology dissertation, where I was kind of comparing Plantinga's epistemology with certain Buddhist epistemology. Mm-hmm. And so that's what got me interested in it. It wasn't until I moved to China when I was at the University of Macau, about an hour outside of Hong Kong, for those who don't know where Macau is, and where I started to write a book. And so I co-authored a book called Classical Theism and Buddhism with Bloomsbury Press, with Eric Baldwin. And there I kind of lay out a way that I think we could see the central metaphysical and ethical commitments of Buddhism as consistent with what I call classical theism. And since then, I've had a couple of papers accepted, waiting for them to be published now, on Buddhism and classical theism. It's a good side project that I like to work on.
Now, you said that it compares classical theism with Buddhism. That's fascinating, right? Because that's going to touch on some questions that I have in relation to Buddhism and whether or not, you know, Buddhists believe that there is a creator. So I'm definitely going to follow up with you about that. But let's first kind of bird's eye view.
Yeah.
Describe Buddhism. What exactly is it? And what are the main branches and perspectives out there?
Okay, yeah, sure. So when we talk about Buddhism, right, generally it's this idea that life consists of suffering, that the suffering is caused by craving or desire. Mm-hmm. Nonetheless, that suffering can be significantly decreased, and that's by following the Eightfold Path, having right realization, having right action, that sort of thing. And when it comes to kind of the right realization, what does that mean? Well, in part, it's going to relate to the metaphysics of Buddhism. And so if you read someone like Jay Garfield, for example, in his Engaging Buddhism. So if your audience is looking for a book on Buddhism that's written by a contemporary analytic philosopher that just kind of gives that the heart of Buddhism, so to speak, he has lists these the following metaphysical theses, namely interdependence, which is to say that all things are conceptually and causally dependent on other things. Right. So for one's existence, for even the very concept of what it is, it depends on other things for its being. That's to say, things don't really have independent being on this view, independent substance within its own intrinsic nature. Mm. And also in impermanence, the idea is that things don't retain their identity from moment to moment. That it looks like we kind of do, right? Like I'm Tyler. but actually, with any sort of subtle change, there's actually significant change, such that really I'm now Tyler 2. And in a minute, I'll be Tyler 3, right? And in a minute, I'll be Tyler 4. And so David Burton says that's who I am. Yesterday is different than I am today, who will be different than, say, tomorrow. And so it's this interdependence and impermanence theses, which lead us to think in part that really reality is empty What does that mean? Well, it just means that there is no, there are no things that independently exist, which retain its identity from moment to moment. That all things truly are empty of own being, so to speak. And so these are the what I take to be this kind of the central metaphysical thesis of Buddhism. Now, there are lots of different Buddhist traditions, especially in ancient times. There's actually Buddhist traditions that, a couple of them at least that I know of, that advocate that there is a permanent self. So sometimes when Buddhism is being discussed, right, Buddhism is discussed as like, oh, they always deny the existence of the self. But that's not completely true. While it is very standard, there are exceptions, especially found in some of the non-Orthodox traditions. Generally, though, today, we can kind of, most scholars kind of categorize Buddhism within three traditions. The Theravada tradition, which emphasizes that the kind of the monastical order and the needing for a monastical order in order to be, to truly reach enlightenment. Then there's the Mahayana tradition, which, like I said, most famously expressed through the philosopher Nagarjuna. Yeah. He authors a really neat volume, scholars call the MMK, that basically, if you're a philosopher, you'll love it, because it's all it is basically just running reductio ad absurdum to different views. And he tries to show that reality ultimately is empty of own being, or at least on some interpretations that things are empty of own being. There's this tradition, which will say that even reality is empty of own being, ultimate reality. There's also a tantric kind of tradition that kind of more esoteric knowledge that not a whole lot is written about. A lot of it's just passed on from, teacher to disciple, that sort of thing. But this is also where you get kind of the maybe using alcohol or like drugs or even sexual activity, right? You might have heard about to reach enlightenment, that sort of thing. So this would be categorized kind of in the esoteric. So these are kind of the three, if we're going to talk about three popular traditions. Medieval tradition that I'm actually really investigating right now, that I've been working on recently. There's a philosopher in medieval times called Del Popa. And Del Popa is a Buddhist philosopher who argues that actually, while reality is empty of other, ultimate reality is empty of other, that things are empty of other, really the reality is not completely empty of being. That there is a being that that we can say exists and that's necessary. He even calls it omnipotent and omniscient, omnipresent. And this is what he calls the Buddha nature. And the Buddha nature is permanent, fixed, immutable, and it underlies all reality. And he actually says that you can't have impermanent and interdependent phenomena without permanent existence, without the Buddha nature. And so this sounds a lot like God, right? And so you have other Buddhist traditions that also talk about nirvana in this way, kind of in a very positive way, where nirvana, this the goal of enlightenment, right, is ineffable, immutable, bliss, pure consciousness, right? And it sounds functionally a lot like theism.
Well, I guess then that's going to be my next question, because I've often heard from Buddhists that there really isn't this ultimate creator. Can you touch a little bit more on that? So I from what I gather, there's different views within Buddhism. Some would affirm this ultimate cause and others would deny it. Is that accurate?
Yeah. So, individuals like Del Popa, like I just mentioned, I think that he would be inclined to accept something really close to theism. If not, maybe if we describe theism in a certain way, maybe if counterfactually speaking, if he was presented with the sort of theism I have in mind, maybe he would say he would. The Buddha was very non-committal, metaphysically speaking. So if you read his sermons, he gets asked sometimes, like, is the universe eternal, or is the soul really permanent, or, you know, these sorts of questions. And he's not committal. He's like, if I say this answer, you're going to say this. If I say this answer, you're going to say that. And this isn't good. We just need to focus on enlightenment. And so, yeah, he's pretty non-committal when it comes to extravagant metaphysical claims outside of this idea of impermanence and interdependence, and ultimately this idea of emptiness. And so he does have conversations with Brahman, right? Kind of the Indian conception of God. But if you read it, Brahman's very personalistic. He's very anthropomorphized. So it's like showing Brahman doesn't know certain things, right? Making Brahman kind of look silly, seeing Brahman as an object within the wider universe. And it does seem that the Buddha has negative views about this. Years later, within the Buddhist tradition, various arguments against God's existence come up and are developed within the Buddhist literature. Like, how can the permanent interact with the impermanent? Or what about the problem of evil, right? These sorts of questions. I do take it, though, that a lot of these are aimed at more anthropomorphized kind of Indian religious traditions rather than what I call classical theism. And so since the Buddha was not super committal on metaphysical views outside of impermanence and interdependence, I think that there's definitely room here where we can talk about synthesis. And when it comes to the kind of the mere Buddhism, to follow C.S. Lewis's term, right, on mere Christianity, when we're talking about at least how it's contemporarily articulated, right? Again, the main metaphysical theses of Buddhism are just interdependence and impermanence, which apply to things. And so I think that as long as we can kind of show that these theses are consistent with classical theism, we're in good standing.
Now, how popular is the view of, you know, this ultimate cause, ultimate creator within Buddhism? Is it kind of a minority position?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there definitely are those who advocate that kind of nirvana is this positive thing, not just this release of samsara, this release of suffering, but it is more positive bliss, pure consciousness type attitude here. But if you read a lot, especially of the secular kind of Buddhist philosophers or the more naturalistic Buddhist philosophers, nirvana is pretty much seen as kind of just this in more negative terms. It's the absence of suffering, that sort of thing. And so it's really more of not so much a debate about historicity, but about logical consistency. At least that's what my work consists of, where we say, all right, is there logical consistency between these central metaphysical theses and the central metaphysical theses of classical theism? So that's what I'm really interested in. There was a Jesuit who was one of really our first great missionaries to Buddhists in Tibet. Ippolito was extremely well-read in Tibetan Buddhist literature. And he wrote some really good works that you can still even read today, even in English. There's been some recent works translated in English of his. And he kind of makes actually similar arguments that Del Popa mentions about needing permanency to even make sense of impermanent and interdependent phenomena. He basically says, you know, in interdependence, I believe in interdependence. All things are dependent on other things, right? And ultimately, they're all dependent on God. And so, you know, he kind of takes a similar approach. And so that's kind of the approach that I'm continuing in. So I don't know, it might be a good idea to talk about what I mean by classical theism and then maybe how that synthesizes.
Yeah, please do. Absolutely.
Yeah, so some of your viewers might be familiar with this debate that's going on in analytic philosophy of religion, where there's a debate about how should we conceive of God, right? So should God be conceived as fundamentally a person, just like you and I? Now, God's not an average person. He's all-knowing and all-powerful and all-loving, etc. But we do understand God to be a being in the same sense that we are beings. He is ultimately a thing or an entity. And so then there's this, some versions of this have that God is actually not metaphysically simple. That's to say that God actually is made up of various parts, various properties, just like I have properties, say being 6 foot plus, brown hair, glasses, blue eyes, human. God is, has properties too. And so God is a thing, if you'd say. Then there is more. So this strand is represented by like my good friend, William Lane Craig, my hero, Alvin Plantinga. It's very popular amongst certain Protestant philosophers of religion, especially. Then there are Catholic philosophers, right, who are inclined not to think so much this, right, who obviously it's Catholic dogma to say that God is metaphysically simple. He's not made up of parts. When we say that God is all-powerful or all-loving or all-knowing, right, these are really just shorthand descriptions of confessing this, the one and the same thing. Right? They look different to us, but in reality, they're ultimately describing one of the same thing, namely that God is existence, that God is, right? God's identical, his essence just is existence, right? He just is existence itself, right? And so God is not a thing here, right? God is not an entity. Rather, he, as the Neoplatonic tradition, as Pseudo-Dionysius talks about, God is no thing. Right, he's nothing. And it sounds, you know, controversial or like it sounds, you know, kind of sinister even. But if you actually understand what Pseudo-Dionysius means by no thing, it's not so much that. As Herbert McCabe talks about, you know, God can't be a thing because he's the grounding of all things. If we're talking about the grounding of all things, right? And, we're not talking about some sort of like self-causation or circular causation, right? Then the grounding of all things can itself be a thing. He is no thing. And so here...
And by the way, just when you say no thing, you're not saying he... Because a lot of people hear that to mean he just doesn't exist.
Right.
There is no God. That's you're right. Saying he's not a thing in any kind of way that we know.
That's right. He doesn't possess properties, right? Sometimes you can construe a thing as that which is capable of possessing a property. I'm not saying that he's empty of own being, right? There is being simpliciter. He is existence itself, right? After all. But he's not a piece of furniture within the universe, right?
Right. And when you say he doesn't have properties, you're not denying things like God is love, God is truth.
Right.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, so I would say like analogically, we could say God has properties by analogy, something like properties, yeah. Or we can refer to him as having these kind of analogical predications like St. Thomas would. But what I'm saying is that not in a univocal sense, God doesn't have properties. God is simple, again. they look like different properties to us, but they're actually all describing one and the same reality, namely existence itself. God is existence itself, as St. Thomas and his Deante proof, you know, shows. So then you have existence, right? And then we exist in some lesser degree, in a different sense, right? We participate. Our existence derives from existence itself, right? And so ultimate reality then really is just existence. And in an ultimate sense, we aren't ultimate existence, right? We exist in some lesser degree. We participate in existence. We don't exist by our very essence. Our essence just isn't to exist. And so in some sense, you could say we're empty. we're interdependent. And so on. So anyway, it seems to me that if you take this kind of classical theism approach, especially as articulated by kind of the Blackfriar Thomistic tradition, think Father Brian Davis or Father Herbert McCabe, pseudo-Dionysius, right? It seems actually that we can affirm interdependence and impermanence and emptiness if we're applying these theses to objects or entities or things. But if God is not a thing, not an entity, but rather the grounding of all entities and things, then we can affirm that God still is immutable and passible and ineffable and simple and all these things. And now when we're talking about God, it's sounding a lot like Del Popa and saying that there is permanent reality. There is this Buddha nature that is pure consciousness and bliss. It sounds like there's the Buddhists who describe nirvana in this way. It sounds like that, there's a lot here that can be synthesized.
Could a Buddhist accept that God is impermanent and things like that? Or
so, I mean, you could be a Buddhist and think that impermanence and interdependence apply to God, but that wouldn't be the God that say classical theists are talking about, right? Because God is supposed to be immutable, especially if you're Catholic, right? These are all dogmatic things that we have to affirm.
Right.
But so the idea is that since God is no thing, so it's like this, impermanence and interdependence apply to things. Since God is not a thing, it doesn't apply to God. So you can affirm impermanence and interdependence in reference to things that exist, but not have to affirm it with respect to God since he is no thing.
And could a Buddhist get on board with that?
Yes, I think so. Yeah.
Okay. So there's some overlap here.
That's
possibly.
Right. That's right.
Now, I guess that kind of brings me to the next question. I mean, are there dogmas within Buddhism, or can it evolve theologically just depending on the person you're talking to? Or are there just certain guardrails that you just can't cross as a Buddhist?
Yeah. So I think a little bit of both. Definitely it evolves. I mean, so there are like traditions within Buddhism that, like I said, have a much more positive, almost classical theist type spin on what nirvana is. Other Buddhist traditions, not so much. You have Buddhist traditions like the Pure Land tradition, which basically, if you have personal devotion to a particular Buddha, you basically say something kind of like the sinner's prayer. you have this devotion to him, that when you die, you will be born again in a pure land. And a land just like Eden, where you're going to be able to reach enlightenment, right? Based off of another person's ultimate work, right? I mean, what does this kind of sound like to you, right? Buddhist traditions evolve, they develop, they talk, they reject certain things, they come to accept certain things. Like I said, some Buddhist traditions, have accepted the permanency of the self, right? What I take, almost all Buddhist traditions, or maybe you can even say all Buddhist traditions, right, are going to accept the impermanence and interdependence theses. And they're going to accept, the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. That's what I take basically mere Buddhism to be. And so I think that those are things that pretty much are substantial. They're not really, not a lot of room for wiggling around those. But if you find conceptual ways to endorse these while also endorsing classical theism, I think that's really important for evangelism, because if we can show that it's not so much that they have to reject their central metaphysical theses, but hey, look at the evidence for the resurrection of Jesus, right? Hey, there's evidence there. Maybe what you can do is realize that Christianity has a lot going for it. You know, accept the gospel, repent and believe in the gospel, and you don't have to just completely, you know, jettison your entire worldview, right? Vatican II is very clear on this kind of approach to other religions, right? We see that Vatican II talks about how that God has a secret presence in other nations, right? Another hinting at other religious traditions. God has a secret presence in them, right? That all truth is God's truth, and that you know, God can reveal himself and give and guide other traditions. Ultimately, of course, anything that's at odds with the church isn't true. It is in conflict and needs to change. But the kind of general disposition of Vatican II, as well as what we see, you know, with the great Jesuit evangelists from the, you know, the 16th, 17th century and forward on, and the evangelists of the New World, right? What we see is this idea of why not imagine that God is really, really big, that he has had his hand in everything, and that you know, he's laid down certain religious truths or guided traditions to make sure that they endorse certain religious truths as preparation work for, in the future, accepting the gospel.
Could Catholics get on board with the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path, or are there some fundamental differences there?
Yeah, so I think so. So in our book, Classical Theism and Buddhism, you know, not only do we do the metaphysical stuff, but we do also the ethical stuff. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there are different ways to talk about the Four Noble Truths. Some people will want to say that life just is like inherently suffering, or some people say that life just has significant suffering, right? And so depending on how we're going to parse these out, will depend on obviously what we can say is true or good or right. But if you just want to say that life as we know it has significant suffering, that seems obviously true. And, you know, what about desire? It's not just like desire simpliciter, right? It's desiring things with wrong realization. That's really what contributes to suffering. And so what do we see? We see, like, what do we tend to do as humans? We make ultimate reality about us. We ultimately think that, like, we are existence, that we are ultimately what is real, that the center of the universe is on us, right? But that's not the case. And thinking this wrong realization, it brings us suffering, right? We crave, we desire things that aren't really permanent, that aren't really independent. And we desire them and think that they are independent and impermanent. And are permanent. But they're not, right? And this causes great confusion, great suffering, right? Because ultimately, what is ultimately real, what is ultimate reality is God, right? And so, you know, we confuse object for God. We confuse creature for God. And that's what Romans 1, you know, is talking about as well. And so, you know, if there is a solution to this suffering, and if the solution is ultimately, right, following the Eightfold Path, and which is having right action and right realization, right speech, that sort of thing. And part of right realization is recognizing Yahweh as supreme, as ultimate reality, and that's part of the resolution to end significant suffering, then yeah, I don't see, if it's glossed in this way, I don't see any problem with that.
Is there some kind of overlap between perhaps a Buddhist conception of what we might call salvation with what, again, Catholics conceive salvation to be?
Yeah, so if salvation part is having right realization that mm-hmm. God is ultimate, that we are not, mm-hmm. Then yeah, I mean, I think that there is overlap, right? It's recognizing that, obviously that's not complete, right? For a Christian and salvation, right? Christ mm-hmm. is complete. Christ contains all the truth. Christ, his sacrificial death on the cross, we need to believe that in order to be saved, whether it be implicitly or explicitly, as Lumen Gentium, you know, talks about, I think roughly around section 16, right? But you know, Christ is who saves. And so nonetheless, I think all what Buddhism is talking about is consistent, at least with theism. I'm not saying it's sufficient in itself. It's not.
Yeah.
Only yeah. Christ is sufficient. But I think that there's definitely a logical consistency there. And like I said, you do have certain Buddhist traditions that became popular in Japan and in China, this kind of Pure Land tradition that latches on another enlightenment, you know, another person's work, basically, for our own salvation. So I think that there is a lot there that we can draw commonality with. Anyway.
It may have been John Paul II or Benedict, I don't recall which one, but they said something to the effect that Christianity is where Buddhism leaves off. You know, Christianity begins where Buddhism ends, like that. What do you think about that?
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I mean, when you look at the positive statements about Buddhism that the church has made since Vatican II on, that have been repeated through various popes, and even recently the latest Buddhist you know, kind of dialogue that was released this year, I forget what it was called, but yeah, I mean it's been like, let's look at all the truths in Buddhism, let's see the commonality, there's a lot of truth there, let's go ahead and figure that out. I think that's really important, like I said, especially for this kind of pre-evangelization. So again, you know, just so your viewers don't misunderstand what I'm saying, you know, John 14:6, right? Jesus says, "I'm the way, the truth, the life. No one comes to the Father but through me." Acts 4 says, "There's no other name under heaven or earth that anyone is saved except Christ Jesus." I think Jesus is the only way. Buddhism in itself is not sufficient for salvation. Nonetheless, I think what we can say is that there's a lot there in Buddhism that is consistent with theism. That we can accept for prolegomena, for the gospel. And ultimately, seeing Vatican II, Lumen Gentium, and seeing how it's been received by Pope John Paul II, by Pope Francis, and so on, that, you know, Buddhists can be right with God, can be believing in the gospel without explicitly believing in Christ. They can do so by implicitly believing in Christ. If the Spirit of God is and grace has come upon them and they're accepting the truth that they know that points to Christ, that's a preparatory work for Christ, then in the same way that Abraham believed the gospel, we can say that they believe the gospel. But ultimately, it is Christ only who saves. So just because God has kind of guided, might have a secret presence in other religious traditions, has guided certain truths to make sure that they're articulated or revealed certain things, and to some lesser degree in other traditions, that doesn't say anything about the there not being a need for the gospel, because obviously there is. And what does the church tell us? That we need to bring everyone in the fullness of truth, that they can have an official objective relationship with the church for their own salvation and the well-being of the world.
Are there canonical scriptures that Buddhists all agree on, or are there like different canons? And what role does, I guess, scripture play for a Buddhist? Because, you know, for us as Catholics, we believe this is divine revelation. I suppose most Buddhists wouldn't see it that way. Are these just valuable writings of humans? Talk a little bit about that.
Well, the main canon is going to be the Pali Canon. So there are various canons, and then people will add on to them, like, okay, if we're going to be in this tradition, we need to accept so-and-so's works and so-and-so's works as well. There are different canons. There were councils, just like Christianity has had, that helped decide certain issues about canon or about practice, especially pragmatic practices, right? There's been important councils that have done that. There's been one instance where like Del Popa is like, I'm just going to kind of talk about the fourth council, my own council. This is what it says, right? And then, you know, you might have like this question, this epistemic question about which tradition, right? There's so many Buddhist traditions. You know, which one is the right one, or which one has the most truth, or and so what they do is oftentimes at least more traditional Buddhists will appeal to something like apostolic succession, and it'll be like, well, we're in line with you know, with the Buddha, we're in line with so and so, we're in line with so and so, and so, you know, that is one style of argument there. But what I try to do is I try to seek which Buddhist traditions resemble classical theism the most, make a lot about that. And then what I try, as mentioned in the Classical Theism Buddhism book, I try to look at the most essential kind of resources, the most kind of essential beliefs, metaphysical and ethical beliefs, and see, is there a logically possible scenario where classical theism and Buddhism can be true, both be true? I'm not saying that Buddhism is true. I'm looking as a philosopher for logical consistency. And just kind of, if we can show logical consistency, the more we can show is logically consistent, the easier it is for the Buddhists to take Christian claims or classical theist claims seriously. So it's going to help a lot with that pre-evangelism.
Well, which groups would you say we're closest to, and which ones are we probably the furthest away from?
Yeah, so I don't have too much of a strong opinion on this. My work, like I said, has been kind of just looking to see what's minimally necessary, because it's easier to show synthesis, right? The fewer tenets you have to take into consideration. But, you know, they have all their elaborate arguments, right? So they'll have... certain traditions will be like, like with Del Popa, for example, they'll say, oh, you know, you're just medieval innovations, right? You're coming out of this, you know, from nothing, right? You're just making this up, right? And Del Popa would be like, no, I'm in these traditions. Look at so-and-so. In fact, he'll like take a couple of different Indian philosophers as well. And he'll say, look, this is what they believe too. I'm just explicating it more thoroughly and showing its coherence with the scriptures and with all the writings that we need to affirm. And so, you know, they battle it out in that way. Similar to how you see within Christian debates as well.
I kind of see I'm getting an alert there. It seems like there's some similarities between Buddhism and Hinduism. From what I understand, you know, Buddhism actually derives from Hinduism, and that's possibly why we see concepts like various gods and demons within Buddhism. Can you comment on that? Is that accurate?
Yeah, I mean, there's a Satan in Buddhism, there are gods that are talked about, but these gods, of course, aren't like classical theism god.
Yeah.
Like objects within the universe sort of thing.
Like an angel kind of?
Contingent things that are dependent and impermanent as well. They're empty ultimately in that sense.
Did they used to be humans, you know, at some point?
Yeah, reincarnation cycle. And there are different ways to understand reincarnation in Buddhism. So there's kind of like this supernatural sense, right, which your listeners are probably more familiar with, where there's almost like these kind of global scales where, you know, your good karma goes in one, your bad karma kind of goes in the other, and that's going to kind of dictate your next next incarnation. But there are more naturalistically kind of reductive accounts where to talk about karma, where since we're all connected, we're all dependent on each other. The sort of bad actions that I do are going to affect me, and are going to affect my, you know, Tyler 2 and Tyler 3. And it's also going to affect you and everyone else around me. And the more bad karma, the more bad actions that I put into to reality, the harder that's going to be to reach enlightenment, not just for me, but for the world. And so if we're just talking about karma in this sense, then again, to me, it seems like we can, that seems logically consistent with classical theism. Obviously, this kind of reincarnation stuff, that doesn't seem so consistent. That would be something that I think a Buddhist needs to reject if they're going to accept Christianity, for example.
Is that one of those guardrails where they just, you know, can't violate?
Yeah, so I don't think so. So, I mean, if you read especially contemporary analytic Buddhists, philosophers, they're not going to even accept reincarnation.
Okay.
Or at least make a big deal out of it. Okay. Obviously, if we're talking about various traditions, maybe you would think that those are essential. But if we're taking a bird's eye view, looking at just kind of commonality, what we can talk about with all Buddhist traditions, I don't think that's necessary. when it comes to, the Buddha, right? Siddhartha Gautama, he came from India. He was as far as we can tell, he was an attractive man who was rich and spoils. He was really dissatisfied, though, with suffering, and to the point where he actually, some sources say that he abandoned his family in the middle of the night and went out to seek enlightenment. He was a practicing Hindu, observed various Hindu traditions and practices, didn't find them satisfactory, didn't find them that they helped, ended up with a kind of a group, a posse, and they were just trying to reach enlightenment, and they were like going hardcore, where basically the Buddha was almost going to die, right? From just all the ascetic practices and stuff like that. Finally, one day the Buddha reaches enlightenment, right? Understands these Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. And he is able to nurse himself back to health. His comrades are like, "Wait, you've betrayed us. You look healthy. What's going on here?" Right? "You gave up searching for enlightenment." He's like, no, I got it. Right. And so then he travels around India and teaches what we now call Buddhism. And so, yeah, I mean, Buddhism is an Indian tradition. I know it's not so common in India anymore. I know when Westerners think of Buddhism, they think China, they think Japan, they think Thailand, because obviously Buddhism still has dominant strands within these countries. But these countries have helped shape Buddhism and have evolved Buddhism into their own kind of cultural, sociological, factions. But I do think obviously there is a lot here, especially when you look at the Buddhist traditions that are describing nirvana as bliss, pure bliss and pure consciousness, right? There's a lot in common with, like, say, Shankara's Advaita Vedanta Hinduism, which says reality ultimately is this kind of impersonal Brahman, sometimes described as pure bliss or pure consciousness, right? So I do think there is some overlap for sure.
Now, the Buddha believed in reincarnation. Are Buddhists free to disagree with the Buddha on these particular points?
The Buddha accepted reincarnation as part of his Indian worldview, right? Whether he really believed in reincarnation or just using it as a tool to, you know, discuss his doctrines, etc. But if you were to take kind of like collective Buddhist traditions, and especially how Buddhism is articulated in the West and analytic philosophical literature, reincarnation is not going to be seen as an essential tenet. So if you read someone like Jay Garfield, reincarnation is not mentioned as kind of like this mere Buddhism depiction that he paints. So that's kind of what I would say to that.
So it's a little different than a Christian disagreeing with something Jesus taught, right? It's not the same kind of role in governing doctrine.
There's even this hermeneutic called skillful means within the Buddhist tradition. So what you had is when the Mahayana tradition starts to become more prevalent, there were certain things in the Mahayana tradition that maybe seemed at odds with early Buddhist tradition. And so it was like, how are we going to synthesize the two, right? How can both be true? And so this skillful means hermeneutic would say, these things were mentioned as true because they were expedient. for our salvation. They were expedient for our enlightenment. They helped with our enlightenment at the time. But now as we've kind of matured and evolved and are more well-grounded in the Buddhist way, we're ready for a teaching that isn't just expediently true, but is true to a more essential degree. So think about it like this. You're in a science class in high school or in middle school, and you're learning heavy scientific facts, right? But your teacher's probably using a lot of analogies and might even say things that are kind of technically false, but nonetheless kind of get your mind in the right place to kind of get a bit of a comprehension of what's going on. And then you get to college or you get to graduate school and you start learning the sciences and you see you kind of no longer maybe need the analogies or you know these kind of half-truths that you were learned in high school are now kind of done away with, and you understand them in a different way. You can kind of see the prior teaching as expedient, but not ultimate, so to speak. And so the Buddhist tradition does have this. And so even when we're talking about, you know, well, maybe the Buddha would even reject classical theism, or maybe he taught against classical theism or something like that. Mm-hmm. You could technically look at that as a skillful means that the Buddha was using. That, you know, maybe God was so anthropomorphized, gods were so anthropomorphized in his Hindu context that he was like, no, we need to reject theism. We need to reject God. We need to reject Hinduism for the time being. But once we mature and understand and come to better enlightenment or better grounded within the Buddhist structure of reality, now is time to learn that these were kind of half-truths. Yeah, those gods don't exist, but there is being beyond being. There's that which is beyond being, right? And so there's a skillful means hermeneutic that I think you can also avail yourself to.
You know, that kind of sounds familiar, like some things we actually do with scripture. You know, we certainly see geocentric language in scripture, right? But I don't think that we would say that God is actually indicating that this is really how the heavens function. But right, it was useful in communicating with people in that way, because that's just the way the senses perceived right things.
Hey, so I've got some rad tribe friends. Here. I've got some rad tribe friends on Facebook who disagree with that.
Right. Yeah, I know. But, you know, I kind of think that we do have that element within Christianity. So there might be some overlap there. Again, for those who reject geocentrism, there's an overlap there. I suppose they would also say that hell is literally in the earth, too.
Yeah. Yeah. And literal fire and so forth.
Uh-huh. So I'm curious, the way we see Buddhism expressed today in its various forms, does it differ significantly from what the Buddha taught? And do we even know that the Buddha taught these things? Does it actually, in kind of the way that we can verify that the teachings of the apostles actually go back to the apostles? Mm-hmm. Can we actually know that this goes back to the Buddha, and how much does it compare and contrast with what we see in other expressions of Buddhism today?
Right. So there's definitely a lot more elaborate metaphysics, a lot more elaborate religious views that occur within actual Buddhist traditions today and, you know, in the medieval times and so forth. In reference to the historical Buddha, there was a time, I believe, maybe it was the early 20th century. You know, skepticism was just in the air in the early 20th century for some reason, right? And there was a time when, where there was a little bit of question, like, what, did the Buddha really exist? Or is he like not really a person, or kind of like Buddhist mysticism, right? If you know the Jesus mythicism, right? Buddhist mythicism. But that is pretty much, from my understanding of the scholarship, rejected today. The paradigm view is that there really was a real Buddha. We can kind of know minimal big picture ideas about him. Whether, you know, everything that he said was exactly what he said, of course, you know, that's something to take on faith, or that's something to take the authority of your Buddhist teachers, right? And then ultimately, though, with Buddhism, you know, there's even this Zen tradition that says, basically, like, the Buddha, he doesn't matter too much, right? What matters is his steps to enlightenment. So there's one Buddhist tradition that actually says, if you see the Buddha, you should kill the Buddha. Just showing you how, not like Christianity, Buddhism can be at sometimes when it comes to how they look at Buddha. It's not the same as how we Christians look at Jesus, right? Though I guess in some sense we did kill Jesus. but that wasn't a good thing. Though Felix Culpa. So I don't know if that kind of brings some clarity to that.
It does. And I've heard that the Buddha was considered a saint in some parts of church history. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I'm not actually so sure about this. I haven't come across this. I do know, like, with Ippolito's work, he does try to basically say, like, show as much in common with the Buddhist tradition, kind of says, you know, really nice things about the Buddhist traditions and so forth. It wouldn't surprise me if there were Catholics at various points in time in history thinking that the Buddha was kind of like a saint of some sort.
Yeah, I think it was based on Barlaam and Josaphat. They're
okay.
Saints in the Christian tradition. They're supposed to be based on the life of the Buddha.
I see. Oh, yes, I have heard of this. That's right. That's right. I don't know too much about that, but you're right. I have heard of this. I don't see why we can't look at Buddha the same way as we look at, say, Aristotle or Plato.
Uh-huh.
Someone who, using reason, right, comes up with a lot of truths, and that can act as preparatory work for the gospel. And so, as far as I can tell, the Buddha was a holy person, a person that was, you know, pious and upright. It's beyond my ken to figure out if he had a relationship with Christ. I hope so, an implicit one with the future Christ. I'm hopeful of it, and I think that that Buddhism can absolutely give us some preparatory work for the gospel. And like I said, I think there's a lot there that's logically consistent. That's kind of, you know, my take on that.
Somebody mentioned in the chat the darker side to Buddhism. They mentioned a Chode ritual. I haven't looked into that ritual, but I've heard of some weird stuff with various versions. I mean, obviously, again, not all Buddhists are the same. And, can you maybe comment on that? Is there kind of a dark side to some of these?
Yeah, well, I mean, some of the tantric stuff, right? Getting high or drunk or having sex with a non-spouse or, you know, whatever. To reach enlightenment. I mean, those would be different practices that I think are totally incompatible with Christian belief. Mm-hmm. And obviously there's been, wars and deaths and so forth in the name of Buddhism, which obviously I would, you know, disavow. I'm not a Buddhist. I don't believe in the impermanence theses. For example, even though I think it's logically consistent with classical theism. We're to accept what's true, what's good, what points to Christ. We don't have to accept everything, right? And my point is just that there's a lot there that can be accepted as preparatory work, a lot more than what we generally think. I mean, if you look at certain books that are put out by, and I consider myself a center right Catholic, just in case anyone's wondering, like, is this guy totally crazy? Like, no. Like, I look up Denzinger whenever I'm going to believe something to make sure that what I'm believing in is in line with the church. My point is just that when you look at certain conservative, very conservative Catholic takes on Buddhism, it's generally like Buddhism and theism are utterly incompatible, or Catholicism and Buddhism are utterly incompatible. And I'm basically saying, oh, well, hold up right there. Hold up. You know, is that necessarily true? Or just, is Buddhism, can it be interpreted in various ways that there's a lot more going for it than how these kind of general kind of almost straw man or a general like characters that we're kind of creating. Is there more to it than that? I think there is.
I know we're almost out of time, so I have just a couple more to sneak in real quick here. But if you got to cut it short at any point, let me know. That's fine.
What
would you say is an effective way to communicate with Buddhists and bring them to Catholicism?
Yeah, so I've got some Buddhist friends who are philosophers, and what I've done is kind of the similar strategy that I lay out in the book, which is to say, okay, well, here's what I take to be essential to Buddhism: impermanence, interdependence, which leads to emptiness. This is how you can understand impermanence, interdependence, and emptiness. Does that sound good to you? Yeah? Okay, great. Well, on some versions of theism, this wouldn't be a problem. Because here's what this sort of theism that I'm talking about says. Here's this classical theism. Talk about Pseudo-Dionysius, talk about this kind of Black Friar tradition. So, well, if you don't apply these theses, if you only apply to these theses to objects or entities or things, well, and God's not one of these, then there's no inconsistency with affirming God's existence, with affirming Buddhism, metaphysical thesis. In fact, there is actually even Buddhist strands, Buddhist traditions that seem to talk about the need for a permanent Buddha nature, for a permanent nirvana that is bliss, that is pure consciousness. And maybe we're actually seeing these things converge. So do you see that's plausible? Yeah, you do? Okay, great. Well, what about the evidence for the resurrection of Jesus? Here's the evidence, XYZ, right? William Lane Craig, Michael Acona, N.T. Wright sort of stuff, right? To some degree, Dale Allison even. Okay, great. Might Del Popa be right that you need some permanent reality to make sense of impermanent reality? And if so, looking at these facts, might it be plausible that God, this permanent reality, raised Jesus from this dead, the pure consciousness, pure bliss, the ineffable, raised Jesus from the dead? And if so, we should take Jesus' claim seriously, that he was the Son of God, that he came to seek and save the lost, that he came to give his life as a ransom for many. Talk about through his death and resurrection that we have forgiveness of sin. And, encourage them to read the Gospels and just start calling out to, God. If you're there, show yourself through the life and work of Jesus. That's how I would kind of handle it.
Very helpful. Thoughts on Thomas Merton?
Yeah. So everyone, usually when they read my work, they're like, oh, I bet you just love Thomas Merton, et cetera, et cetera. I know obviously about him. I know also there's like controversy around him. I actually haven't read too much of his work or looked too much into him. So I can't give like in good conscience say like, oh yeah, he's great, or no, he's not. So I'll kind of just pass on answering the Thomas Merton question. Instead of Thomas Merton, what I will do though is recommend Ippolito Deserati, this 16th century Jesuit priest. Let's see if I have his work here. Let's see. It's right. Well, yes. Here's a really good book. It's an English translation of Ippolito Deserati. You can get it on Amazon. He'd be a guy that was very, very knowledgeable. He studied with Buddhists. He was in monastical settings. He was extremely bright. I would encourage people who are interested in Catholic Buddhist dialogue, of course, besides reading my work, I would encourage them to read Ippolito Deserati.
Any other plugs you want to sneak in there before we end the show?
No, I mean, I've got my own YouTube channel called Furthering Christendom, if anyone's interested in that. And then you can follow me on Twitter. I can't even remember what my own handle is. I think it's just Tyler McNabb. let's see what my handle is. It's Tyler D. McNabb, sorry.
Okay.
And then if you just want to email me, I'm an associate professor of philosophy at St. Francis University. So you can find my email there.
Tyler, thank you so much for coming back on. This was incredibly helpful. You are welcome on anytime. I'd love to get you back on.
Thank you very much. You have a wonderful day.
Thank you. Thank y'all. Everybody hit the like button and the subscribe button. We'll see y'all later. God bless.